each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. And I am joined, as I am every Monday now, by my co-host Loretta Freilich, a former criminal prosecutor for the Cook County State's Attorney, now a dynamic talk show host and retreat leader and evangelist and many, many other things, prayer warrior. So welcome. We're here sitting in for Father Anthony, and we're glad that you're with us. We have a really interesting show lined up for you today. Loretta, how was your weekend?
Well, mine, Mary, was lovely. We had the 8th grade confirmation retreat this weekend.
Okay.
Which, as our listeners know, I am a catechist for the 8th graders.
Very good.
Not for the faint of heart.
Yes, yes. God love you.
Well, guess what? He does. And I love him, and I love those little kids. And we had Mark Nemo and his daughter, Noelle.
Okay. Oh, how wonderful. How did you get them for a high school retreat? Was it just your parish, or was it a combined parish thing?
No. It was just my parish. Mark did it because he's my friend.
Oh, how wonderful.
And I asked him, and this is the second year that he did it, and everyone was so blown away by his retreat the year before. And I'm talking parents, kids and parents. You know, Mark, his nickname is Man of God, and he is so united to Christ in everything that he does and says that you can just feel God oozing out of him. And people naturally want to go forward.
Wonderful.
You know, and it was one of those...
How many kids?
We had 65 plus their parent or sponsor.
Okay. Wow.
So it was a busy
room. So the sponsors
room.
Had to go.
Oh, yes.
Oh, excellent.
Yes. But what really touched me at the end of the retreat, the sponsors or the parents write their students... or their children,
right.
A letter of affirmation.
Oh, how beautiful.
It is beautiful.
That's
and I
very
know,
nice.
You know, it's kind of traditional high school sort of Kairos sort of thing to
right,
do.
Right.
But the response from one of the fathers was, he said, I am embarrassed that it took me to get homework for a Catholic retreat for my son for me to tell him I loved him.
Oh, wow.
And a woman at Mass this morning came up to me. She is very engaged with her daughters, and she was saying what a great retreat it was. So I'm really thankful to God because it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
My legs hurt like you wouldn't
believe. Yeah, I can't imagine. Well, thank you for doing that. Really, on behalf of the worldwide church, thank you for doing that because— You know, this is, you know, the important things aren't happening at the synod. They're happening in parishes where kids who are largely uncatechized are getting to know the Lord personally, because that's what's going to change the world.
You mean the children are not interested in my gender?
Yeah.
Or whether women are deacons or ordained priests?
Yes.
That's not what our kids...
No, that's...
I wish not
90% of the world is concerned about. But anyway, that is a topic for another show,
yes,
my friend.
Yes, and so, I don't want to get in trouble today.
Because we do want to get to our guest who is
yes,
on the phone.
Yes, but I want to tell just one more thing, Mary, because it was so beautiful. One of the things Mark does is he has them write down, you know, something that's troubling them. And without mentioning any names, these kids put on a cross-shaped piece of paper like their biggest burden. You know, a couple of the kids wrote, everyone tells me I suck at everything.
Yeah.
How would you like to be that young boy or girl? I don't know who it is. Without knowing that Jesus doesn't say you suck at anything.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus says you're my beloved son,
right,
or my beloved daughter. That's what we need to be engaging our young people with.
Right.
And if you could have seen the energy, it felt the energy in the room and the smiles on the kids' faces and the noise level. You know, it's so quiet when they get there.
Right, 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 right.
But by the time they're leaving, it's a wonderful experience. So
good.
We want
well,
to thank Mark
God.
Nemo
That's
and his daughter, Noelle.
Okay, well, terrific. Thank you, Mark Nemo, and to you and to everybody else who helped plan that beautiful retreat. I wish everybody could have, every confirmation candidate could have that much attention paid to them. But
amen.
Well, listen, so
how about you? How was your week?
It was fine. It was fine. And so, but our guest is waiting for us on the line here. So let's bring her on. It is Dr. Mary Keene Kirchhoff, who is a neurodevelopmental pediatrician who cares primarily for children and young adults with disabilities. And we're going to be talking to her today about the latest pro-death initiative in Illinois, which is legalizing assisted suicide. Dr. Keene Kirchhoff, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for taking the time in your busy schedule to be with us
right.
today. Can you, why don't we just, let's start at the very beginning, as the Sound of Music would have said, and tell us a little bit about this legislation. What is the name of the bill or the number of the bill? And then can you tell us exactly what it would do?
Okay. Hold on. I'm going to open it up and give you the exact
Wonderful.
Number.
Okay.
And that is so great, Marion, yeah. just like you, because whenever you are on the radio, you are the smartest woman in the
yes.
room.
She's the smartest woman on the airwaves, likely, too. So.
Amen.
Okay, I do not have the number of the bill.
Okay.
But it's the Illinois End-of-Life Options for Terminal Adult Patients Act.
Okay, so it's specifically for adults?
Yes.
Okay.
At this time.
At this point, right, but it's likely going to be. Okay, so, and we'll unpack that a little bit more, Dr. Kirchhoff, but can you please explain to us what this bill purports to do?
Well, this says, this is what it purports to do. This proposed legislation will allow a mentally capable, terminally ill adult with a prognosis of 6 months or less the option to obtain a prescription medication they may decide to take so they can die peacefully and end their suffering.
Okay. Now tell us what that really means, because it's not what you said.
Right. The new term, rather than physician-assisted suicide, that is being widely promoted is medical aid in dying.
Okay.
That is an obvious euphemism meant to soften the truth, hide the truth.
Right.
That this bill is designed to assist patients to take their own life.
It's assisted suicide is what it is.
Assisted suicide.
Yeah, medical aid in dying, isn't that the group that used to be the Hemlock Society?
Well, the medical aid in dying is a new term.
Okay,
This particular bill is sponsored by a coalition including the ACLU and Compassion and Choices.
Okay, Compassion and Choices used to be the Hemlock Society.
Yep.
Right.
Yep, that's exactly
okay.
right. But the medical aid in dying is the new terminology for the last couple of years.
Okay.
It's what they use in Canada and they've used in other parts of the world to hide not only assisted suicide, but now frank euthanasia.
Okay.
Involuntary.
Okay.
Euthanasia. And this generic term, medical aid in dying, obviously is so vague.
Yeah.
That it can include anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's okay. So, all right. So let's. I want to just make sure our listeners, Dr. Keene, fully understand the implications of this, because I think you know people who are compassionate people, good people. No one wants to see another person suffer, and they don't see sometimes any value in keeping someone alive when they know they're going to quote die anyway, and so therefore shouldn't they be able to die? You know. And I find it interesting that the language of the legislation purports to say that mentally competent people can make this decision. But I don't know about, well, you would know much better than me because you work with so many patients who are in difficult circumstances. If someone is given a life-limiting diagnosis, that can really either, spiral someone into depression and anxiety, or propel them into some kind of other state where they're not really thinking clearly and their family members aren't thinking clearly. So
exactly. Doctors make mistakes.
Yes. Amen.
The prognosis that physicians make are often inaccurate.
Do you have any examples of that, Mary, that you could share with us from your own experience as a physician?
Oh, well, sure. I've had many over the years.
Okay. And, I think it would be...
had many over the years,
because
including little children,
right.
Children and adults.
Right. Well, I'd love to hear you. I want you to share some with us because, the only thing we ever hear is, Brittany Maynard dying of brain cancer and she was in agony and no one could help her. Like that, these are the stories that we hear. We don't hear the stories about the people that were told you've got 6 months to live and then 2 years later they're still alive.
Right. Oh, I have... probably more than a dozen children that I care for who now are in their teens, whose parents told them they were never going to live beyond their 3 or 4 years old.
Wow.
And these little children are disabled, but they're happy, and their parents love them. They have a beautiful quality of life, probably better than a lot of the teenagers that we see who are so clearly so unhappy when you see how they dress and how they act
right.
and what they
right,
do.
Right.
So these children are, and I guess that probably is one reason that they're alive, that they do so much better than the doctors think they would.
Yeah.
Because they experience God's love through their parents, through
right.
their caregivers.
Right.
Amen. Mary, as you may or may not know, our listeners have heard that my mother died this past September, and she was in the hospital. And a very good hospital, I'm not going to say the name of the hospital, but she suffered a stroke in August and then died in September. I want you to know every doctor I encountered approached me about a DNR, a do not resuscitate order. And I have to tell you, I looked at these people as though they were speaking another language. I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, well, if. And I said, no, there's no if.
Mm-hmm.
My mother and I have discussed this, and not last week, but, 10 years ago when we're sitting on a beach and having a wonderful time, and I'm asking her, how do you feel about this? What is it you want done with your body, and how do you want to handle it? And she always told me she did not want a DNR. And so I was really struck. I'm talking every doctor, the ER, the doctor as we came to the floor that she was going to be hospitalized on. Even a nurse took me out of the room to discuss it with me. And there were several hospitalizations, and each time it was the same questions. Did I want to? I'm like, no. And so, I would always ask her, and she was fully in the game.
Yeah, she was. I can attest to that. Yes,
so she was
more so than most
other people.
Well, Mary knows my mom too. So
yeah.
Mary knows.
She was a force with which to be contended.
My mom was born fully in the game, but I look at her and say, "Mom," and I do it quietly. Is this something you want? Her eyes got as big as they could, and she would whisper and say to me, "I want to go home," and I'd ask. Do you want to go to his house? And I'd point to heaven. Or I'd say, do you want to go to our house? And she'd say, our house.
Mm.
Now, 2 days after we got her home to our house, she did go home to God. But I fully believe she wanted to die at home peacefully. It was not something she wanted in this hospital filled with lights and tubes and noise. And I find it so odd that the hospital would push that, the medical professionals would push that repeatedly.
Well, it's much worse than that. A DNR means that you're allowing God to take you if you think it's, if it's the time. But we're talking about euthanasia.
Right.
We're talking about doctors and other healthcare providers, nurse practitioners, who are actually actively assisting individuals to kill themselves.
Right. So, which is a different thing from a DNR in terms of the, yes, the medical ethics of it.
But where, yes, does this come from, Mary? Where does this come from? How has this crept in to our healthcare? And I use that term loosely.
Yeah, it's not all simple, but part of it is a prejudice against people with disabilities.
Right. Okay. Okay. Let's talk about that for a little bit, because I know that is really your area.
Yeah. Many physicians and other healthcare providers have a prejudice against people with disabilities. I noticed that back when I was a resident in 1980. As a rehabilitation resident, we had a man who had severe quadriplegia from a car crash. He was ventilator reliant. And there were specialist physicians, for example, infectious disease, who declined to even perform a consult because they made a decision that this person wasn't worth keeping alive.
Wow.
Similarly, way back in 1980, a good friend of mine, brother, who happened to have CP but worked as an engineer for Boeing, because that's Boeing Seattle, and Boeing used to be the biggest industry there. I don't think it is anymore. But most ER docs don't ask what kind of work you do. So this young man had mild cerebral palsy. He walked with a limp and had a slight slur to his speech. He complained that he was feeling weaker. And the doctors presumed he was intellectually disabled and that he didn't know what he was talking about and sent him home. And 3 days later, he ended up in the ICU with Guillain-Barré.
Wow.
There actually have been big studies looking at physicians and documenting this prejudice. It's very widespread. There was a study done from a Harvard Medical School doctor, mm-hmm, published in Health Affairs in February of 2021, which found that 82% of physicians nationwide view people with disabilities as having a low quality of life.
Right, right.
82%. And then an October 2022 follow-up study documented that physicians will lie to people with disabilities and tell them that their practice is closed so they don't have to deal with them.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
But it's not just physicians. It's not just physicians. It's more than just physicians. I think that, well, here in the United States, there is such a high value put on health and beauty, such a high value placed on health and beauty that people who don't have those things are considered less than those who do.
Yeah, yeah.
So that there's a perception over these many years that disability is a fate worse than death.
Right, 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 right. And we see this a lot with the conversation recently around people with Down syndrome, don't we?
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, there's always been the people like Peter Singer in the world who, you know, believe that they can, you know, decide for themselves whose lives are worth living and whose lives aren't. But when, in fact, when you talk to, you know, adults with Down syndrome, they'll tell you they have very happy lives.
Yes, they do.
Like, if you actually ask the people involved, you know, and but again, let's go back to this legislation and about some of the success cases you have seen of people given a life-limiting condition who then turn around and come back.
Okay, there's a couple of ways we can look at this.
Okay.
From a Catholic perspective, miracles still do occur.
Amen.
And I am aware of two recent cases of women with metastatic breast cancer.
Okay.
Who were absolutely, totally, inexplicably cured.
Wow. Did they ask for the intercession of anyone in particular?
Well, these particular ones that I'm speaking of were cured at a visit at Our Lady of San Juan de los Lagos in Mexico. It's the second largest pilgrimage site in Mexico.
Okay.
And there was also a little girl, 6 years old, who had a very rare, and I've seen a video of this, a little girl who had a very rare form of encephalitis.
Okay.
Where she, over a period of 3 or 4 months, ended up with a trach and a G-tube and was sent home to die. She was privileged to be able to go to this pilgrimage site, Our Lady of San Juan de los Lagos.
Okay.
And the Virgin of San Juan de los Lagos touched her. And
wow.
For the first time in more than a month, she started moving her eyes.
Mm.
The next day, she was standing up in bed.
Wow.
The day after that, they took out her trach and her G-tube.
Glory
and
to
5 days after that, she was back at school.
Oh, glory to God.
Wow. Now, most of my experiences are not that dramatic, but I recently became aware of these and the evidence for them, so I don't want to forget that. But that God does not choose to work that way all the time.
Right. Of course. Right. And sometimes he is calling people who are ill. He is calling them home. But that hospice time is so important to be able to prepare for it. So,
that's another miracle we have to talk about. Anyway.
Well, we are going to, why don't we go to our first break, Mary? And then can you stay over with us?
Yes. Oh,
okay.
Yes,
terrific.
Love to.
Wonderful. Because I don't want to give this conversation the bum's rush. You know, I really want to discuss it. That's what our listeners are looking for in this program is in-depth conversation and analysis of issues. So please don't go away, listeners. We will be back after the break with Dr. Mary King-Kirchhoff. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich sitting in for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change.
Sometimes it's tough to hear winds of change over the air, what with tall buildings, power lines, and other static. Now you can hear Winds of Change anywhere, anytime, or on any device. When Winds of Change is on the air, live, Monday through Friday, noon to 1, go to ststandschurch.org. Scroll down to the Winds of Change tile and click on the Listen Live button. For Winds of Change podcasts, click on Listen to Episodes. You are listening to
Mary Fiorito
and
Loretta Freilich
on Winds of Change. Here is an update on the Fulton Sheen petition.
We Catholics stand just inches from the goal line to have the saint we desperately need now, Venerable Fulton Sheen, publicly declared blessed. Yet new obstacles keep arising to delay this from happening. The Diocese of Peoria is now requiring the unanimous support of the U.S. bishops behind the beatification of Fulton Sheen before a new date is set for the ceremonial Mass. This has never been necessary in the Church's history. The Fulton Sheen Movement's petition drive to set a new date soon for Sheen's beatification Mass now has 10,000 Catholics from around the world clamoring for this. We need this voice magnified by hundreds of thousands more Catholics. And you can help us do that. Take action. Go to FultonSheenMovement.com and sign the petition and share it everywhere because everyone agrees we need Blessed Fulton Sheen now more than ever.
Bye now and God love you.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich on Winds of Change. And our guest today is Dr. Mary King-Kirchhoff, who is a neurodevelopmental pediatrician, long associated with Loyola University Medical Center and Northwestern University's hospital and medical school. Did I get that right, Dr.
Yes.
King? Okay,
yes.
Terrific. And a longtime advocate for not only the pro-life movement, but also for people with special needs and disabilities. Often these types of patients are her very own patients that she cares for. So you had just left us with the wonderful story of a little girl and two women healed of metastatic breast cancer. But you also had mentioned earlier that, you know, patients that you yourself cared for, did not die at the appointed time they were supposed to have died and wound up having a much more positive prognosis. Can you
right.
speak a little bit about that?
Well, I probably have 12 little children, patients under 12, who were told, whose parents were told that they were going to die before they were 3 or 4.
Mm.
And then I have many more patients who were told that their kiddos were going to die, and now they're in their 20s and even in their 30s.
Right.
So, but these and these children do have profound disabilities, but
right.
they're happy and their families love them.
Right.
And you can see that the love that these children have for their families. I see their smiles. I see the joy that they bring each other.
Mm-hmm.
A disability is not a fate worse than death.
No.
Euthanasia is not a treatment. Assisted suicide is not a medical treatment. They're abandonments. Assisted suicide obstructs care that families need.
Mm-hmm.
There's a federal study that the National Council on Disability has very thoroughly documented how the various protections built into laws don't work. Now, the state of Illinois, I'm not going to read the protections that they state. They give their 10 supposed protections against abuse. But every state has put up some sort of protection.
Right.
And they end up being seen as barriers and taken away. And several states that started out with assisted suicide now have legalized frank euthanasia. Did you know that?
Oh, well, it doesn't surprise me. It's always been a slippery slope, I would think.
Yeah, but it's euthanasia is actually legal in several states,
right,
as well as several countries in Europe.
Yeah.
And as soon as they accept voluntary euthanasia, they're in the Netherlands and in Belgium, they've documented involuntary euthanasia.
Oh.
But I want to point out more how assisted suicide laws are dangerous and discriminatory,
yes,
against people with disabilities.
Wonderful, please.
Okay, number one is that insurers have denied expensive, life-sustaining, and sometimes curative medical treatment, but offered to subsidize lethal drugs, potentially leading patients who, like you mentioned, are depressed and anxious towards hastening their own deaths.
Mm.
And as we've already talked about, misdiagnoses of terminal disease can cause frightened patients to hasten their deaths.
Mm.
People with a disability of depression are subject to harm where assisted suicide is legal. Depression is an illness.
Right.
How can you tell a person,
right,
who is depressed? Can a person who is suicidal not be depressed?
Right.
I mean, how do you offer suicide to one individual and assisted suicide to one and suicide prevention to another? And when there have been many documented cases where a person with disability goes to a suicide prevention center, and instead they're asked, well, would you like to have assistance in suicide rather than suicide prevention?
Yeah.
So, and people with disabilities are often demoralized by the treatment that they have received over their years,
yeah,
by healthcare providers and by society.
Right.
People who have a hard time finding housing, people,
right,
who can't get healthcare, people who can't find an aide to help them with their daily living activities.
Right.
All of these things are important for their dignity, and if they're denied, sometimes they'll feel, what is their choice?
Right.
If they don't have anybody to support them in their desire to live.
Yeah. If everyone tells you that you're having a miserable life, you know, sooner or later you're going to start to believe it.
Yeah. And most healthcare professionals don't even realize that they are demoralizing patients. They don't recognize their own prejudice.
Right.
They don't recognize their own prejudice. The other difficulties with these assisted suicide laws and medical aid in dying law here in Illinois is that financial and emotional pressures can distort patient choice.
Right.
That's
a bigger deal than most people realize, I think.
Oh, it's huge.
It's huge.
If a grandma thinks that, oh, my gosh, they won't be able to work, they won't have enough money to pay for the house, or who's going to take care of the kids, or, you know, if they're going to be taking care of me, patients, people who are struggling may feel they don't have a choice.
Yes.
But to choose death to spare their family,
right,
being a burden, and that's an increasing number of people who request assisted suicide.
Right. And you can
is because they don't want to be a burden.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The I don't know, Doctor, if you are familiar with the Magnificat, but I use it. It's a little prayer manual that has, you know, the daily mass and then the prayers of the day, but it always has a little reflection.
You're going to talk about the one for today with Mother Teresa.
Isn't that interesting? So, yeah, if you don't mind my just sharing just two sentences with our listeners, you know, when I pick up a person from the street, who is hungry, I give him a plate of rice or a piece of bread, and I have satisfied. I have removed the hunger. But a person that is shut out, that feels unwanted, unloved, terrified, the person that has been thrown out from society, that poverty is so hurtful and so much, and I find that very difficult. There are many, many people, old people, disabled people, mental people, people who have no one, nobody to love them. They are hungry for love. And, you know, it isn't, and I remember her saying, this is something she kind of, a theme she kind of came back to multiple times, but she said, you know, you in America, you have so much wealth. Maybe you don't have a lot of people who are starving, you know, physically, but you don't love the people who are in front of you with special needs and disabilities, et cetera, et cetera. You have a great poverty of love, I think is what she
said.
Yes,
that's exactly what you said. I just love that. I had pulled that meditation to bring out as well, Mary.
Oh, wonderful. We're like twins separated at birth, Dr. Keene. So,
but beautiful. Dr. Keene, can I ask you, along the lines of what you're talking about, where people are choosing death to spare their family from being a burden, we all know God can intervene at any point. What happens to those individuals that kind of wake up and smell the coffee and think, I really don't want to die? What happens if they've already begun to engage in this kind of, I don't even want to call it treatment, but this kind of assisted killing?
Well, when they're given medicines that they can take at home, we don't know what happens in most of the cases because nobody has to keep track.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody
even
has
better.
To keep data.
Right.
So there's minimal data out of Oregon, but they don't know how many took the medicine.
Right.
And they don't know what happened to the medicine. You know, did a little kid get at it, and did someone die of poisoning? Who knows?
Right.
Who knows? Who knows? No, and they apparently don't want to know.
So there's no required follow-up
The
administration of these drugs.
That's right. There's none at all. If a patient takes the medicine home, at least they do have time to think it over, and they may choose not to. But nowadays, there's this medical aid in dying includes injection. So once an injection is, that's what medical aid in dying is in 10 states and many countries. That's how Oregon started out, just with the pills, but now has IV injections, as does Vermont and several other states.
Wow.
California, Oregon, Vermont, I don't have the list in front of me, all have IV injections legal. And doctors are always given excuse. There is no way to trace or to prove that it was not voluntary.
Huh. Oh, my gosh. So the potential for abuse here is massive.
Yes, you know, and that's what has been seen. Now, the state of Illinois, they say they've got these 10 things that will prevent any abuse, but we know that the studies that have been done by the National Council on Disability, for example, has clearly documented that these sorts of protections and provisions end up not doing anything. They end up being seen as barriers, and they're taken away.
Wow.
In Canada now, if you are depressed, you can ask for an infusion. In the Netherlands, individuals with autism and intellectual disability can ask to be euthanized, and they have.
Ugh.
And among the things I've heard about is it's being proposed as a solution to the drug addicts and homeless.
Oh, wow. Now that'll clean up our streets.
I'm wondering if that's why they're allowing San Francisco to be such a mess. I don't know.
And, you know, and the potential for coercion.
Yes, there absolutely is.
Oh, my goodness. It's just, well, tell me, so this legislation in Springfield.
I've got those House Bill and Senate Bill numbers.
Okay, Mary, would you share them, please?
Certainly. House Bill 601 and Senate Bill 948.
Okay, thank you. Mary, let's talk about the groups who are mobilizing in opposition to these bills.
Okay, there are a bunch of groups that have mobilized together here in Illinois, and
Excellent.
They've been meeting for more than a year. once or twice a month, and trying to prepare and educate people. Excuse me, just a moment. There are lots of websites with good information that I really would encourage people to check out. Hold on, I'm going to get that list out for you.
Okay, terrific. Because I know when we have fought back these bills, when I was very early on as a young lawyer in the pro-life movement, I worked with a number of different organizations. I used to regularly debate somebody from the Hemlock Society, believe it or not. That's how far back this goes, when they were still called the Hemlock Society. And they had a very nice old man, you know, who would debate me. And I mean, he was perfect. It was unlike the abortion debates, which could be very contentious. The assisted suicide debate was much less contentious in a kind of emotionally fraught way. But still, you know, I mean, it's a tough thing to talk about. But I hope he didn't kill himself. I think he probably was, you know, he was planning to. I know it that much when he got to a certain point when he was unhappy with his life. But it was very interesting to see the groups that the coalition, you know, there's that whole saying, politics make strange bedfellows. And so there was a disability right group called Not Dead Yet. Are they still around?
Yeah, they are still around, and they're very active.
Wonderful.
They are very active against these assisted suicide laws. Access Living Chicago is involved with the Illinois Assisted Suicide group. The Patients' Right Action Council is the major organizer behind the Illinois group.
Okay.
And they are out of New York. But the Illinois Catholic Hospital Association and many other groups are involved. The Catholic Medical Association are involved in this effort to try to stop assisted suicide here in Illinois.
Okay.
I ask you, Mary, who is the proponent of each one of these pieces, the main proponent? I know you can sign on to look like you're active, but who brought these bills forward?
I don't have the list. I'm sorry. I know it's here somewhere, but I should have asked you to prepare me by giving me these questions. I am sorry.
I am sorry. No, that's okay. That's our job. We'll get them. We'll get them for our
internet
listeners
here. So I'm a little bit hamstrung, but it's, I think it's probably the usual suspects. I find that a lot of the groups who are behind abortion stuff are generally the same groups that are behind this, you know. And again,
the ACLU and Compassion and Choices, but they have been working behind the scenes for decades.
For decades to get this, I know. And now with Governor Pritzker, who of course will give them whatever they want, you know, they feel like they can, you know, I mean, like what they did with abortion. I mean, they got everything, you know, even taking away parental notification on abortion. And I mean, and unfortunately, you know, it is the vulnerable and the most voiceless who are going to bear the brunt of this kind of stuff, as they always do, right? It's always on the backs of the poor, this kind of stuff.
Killing is never caring. Euthanasia is and so is assisted suicide. It's a direct threat to human dignity.
And it's an opposition to the Hippocratic Oath, is it not?
Yes.
So will the Hippocratic Oath in Illinois then for Illinois medical schools have to be, you know, changed in some way?
Well, I have to tell you, they've been changed for years already.
Oh, no.
They have been changed. They have been changed.
Oh, that's just abominable. You know, and you don't know, my goodness, you go in with it like Loretta did with her elderly mother, and you don't, like, the doctor should be the person you trust the most.
Right, and every doctor, every healthcare provider should consider a request for assisted suicide as a call for help.
Right.
Not to help themselves, but a call for help. Help me deal with the crisis in my life.
And, you know, go ahead, Mary, I'm sorry. But, you know, I had my roommate from college, who was from a very devout Lithuanian family, and her mother died of bone cancer. And as you probably know, that's a very, very painful way to go.
Yes,
and she was not properly medicated, Mary. And she died. I mean, my roommate found her on the bathroom floor one time, just, you know, begging God to take her. She was in so much pain. And, you know, I'd like to go to our last break so we don't get interrupted. But when we come back, can we talk a little bit about the advances that have been made in pain management?
Oh, sure.
And how no one has to die screaming in pain like that. And I believe, you know, my friend has now very, you know, nuanced opinions on assisted suicide because of the way she saw her mother suffer. And I keep trying to tell her, no, your mother's case was completely mishandled. Your mother should not have died in that kind of pain. It wasn't necessary. But anyway, let's go to the break, and then when we come back, we can have an uninterrupted discussion about that particular aspect of the issue. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich here on Winds of Change. Don't go away.
St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, is open 24 hours a day, 7 days per week, for adoration of the Blessed Sacrament in the iconic monstrance. The Blessed Sacrament is reposed during the celebration of Mass and during special events. St. Stan's doors are always open for adoration. Come anytime, day or night. St. Stan's is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, right off the Kennedy. Visit ststanschurch.org.
We are the students of St. Stan's La Costa Academy, and you're listening to the Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy, St. Stan's, is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is conveniently located 1 block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich, and we're joined by Dr. Mary Keene Kirchhoff, who is a neurodevelopmental pediatrician who works primarily with children and young adults with special needs and disabilities. And we are discussing a new horrific initiative in the state of Illinois to legalize assisted suicide, as they do with pretty much everything, in order to make it palatable to people. They're calling it medical aid in dying, just like they call abortion reproductive health care. So don't be fooled. They're changing the language because they know that the thought of assisting a suicide is repulsive to most people, as it should be. But before we went into the break, we were discussing pain control and pain management. And I know that for many people, that is a primary, if anyone would support medical aid in dying or assisted suicide, it would be because they don't want to see a loved one dying in pain, and they're under the impression that people are writhing in agony and nothing can be done to help them. So, Dr. Keene Kirchhoff, can you please unpack that a little bit for us so that we can better understand it?
There are two major points I want to make about that. Number one is that they use this argument very effectively to try to get people to accept medical aid in dying or assisted suicide, whereas less than 5% of the people who ask for assisted suicide are asking because of that kind of pain.
Oh, interesting.
What's
that
greater
percentage
number
again, please?
Less than 5 to 10%. It's more often it's the burden. It's the loss of dignity.
It's the emotional pain, right?
It's not the emotional pain, and don't forget spiritual pain.
Yeah.
Don't forget the spiritual pain. They are not going to get their spiritual pain treated by an IV infusion of a medication.
Right, right.
Having real hospice care, real palliative care, there is no reason for physical pain. There are lollipops of morphine. There are patches for morphine.
Lollipops of morphine? There are thumb drops. Really?
There are many, many, many ways of treating pain, and palliative care doctors do not have the restrictions that orthopedic doctors and doctors like me have.
Right.
Because of the opioid crisis, we're not allowed to dispense medicine like we could five or 10 years ago.
Right.
But palliative care doctors and hospice doctors do not have that restriction.
Right.
Able to use morphine and other very necessary pain-reducing medicines when they are necessary.
Yes.
We need to make sure that the palliative care and hospice organization that we referred our loved ones to recognize that emotional pain and physical pain are not going to respond to those medicines.
But
we want to make sure that we offer spiritual care.
Of course, and that has to be. And that's what, many hospice programs do. And, in fact, I have a very dear friend who was for many years a hospice chaplain. And one of the problems she ran into with her patient was, well, first of all, you know, she did have on a number of different occasions someone who, once they get into hospice and their pain started to be managed in the way that you described, because there weren't restrictions on the opiate usage in the hospice care. Once their pain was being managed well, they started gaining weight.
Yeah.
They were able to get up and move around. And she said in a couple of cases, she told me about personally, a couple of people she was working with, they came out of hospice because they started to do so much better.
I've had a personal friend do the same thing.
Yeah.
Lived another year.
Right, exactly, because they were deteriorating and not eating, et cetera, because they were in so much pain all the time. But she told me one of the things that she ran into with some regularity would be, say, for example, you have a 80-year-old who's dying of lung cancer or something like this. And they would recommend, she was part of the care team. The care team would recommend, you know, starting out like something you were talking about, some, you know, morphine lollipops or what have you, and wound up really getting into very strong words with the children of the patient. And the children of the patient saying things like, well, she literally had someone say this to her, we don't want him to get addicted. And my friend said it was all I could do not to laugh, to say, if he lives long enough to be addicted, this will be a medical miracle, because he's not going to live long enough to get addicted.
Yeah.
But the children were saying, no, please don't give them any of those opiates because they're so addictive.
Oh, that's so sad. And there's no reason for that. We don't want our loved ones to suffer physical pain.
Right.
That way they can heal whatever emotional pain they may still have.
Right.
That may be addressed, and any spiritual pain, any disruptions in family love, have an opportunity for healing
right
before they pass.
Yeah, and I think that's one of God's great mercies, isn't it? Of
yes,
of the dying process, is that it does allow. It does allow people who need, first of all, to reconcile themselves with God, to have the time and to have the initiative to do it, right, and the motivation to do it, to see a priest, to receive the sacraments, to talk through with someone their fears about the afterlife or their, you know, and there's you know, everybody who has been near a hospice program could tell just beautiful stories about, you know, deathbed reconciliations, or really what, you know, we used to pray for that, right? That was,
yeah.
I mean, I remember that, for, you know, to pray for a happy death.
And, yep, you know, Mary, too, you're not just dealing with the person. There's a whole family that's involved, that when confronted with the eternal passing of a loved one, they may need to reconcile with that person. They may need to get themselves, you know, we all live in community. They may need to get themselves in a good place with the person who's going home to God. And so to just make it about the one person who's dying, those people were never just about themselves. They were always in relationship, in a family, you know, among friends, in a community. So, you know, we never know what God is calling to be part of that person's end of life.
Right.
And you're bringing up another point. Acceptance of suicide leads to more suicide.
Oh.
So Oregon suicide rate.
Yeah. Explain that, Mary.
Went up. Well, you can look at the Oregon data. The Oregon suicide rate climbed disproportionately after they allowed assisted suicide. By 2010, which was, I think, 16 years after they made it legal, their suicide rate was 41% above the national average.
Wow.
And that has happened every place where assisted suicide has been legalized. Life is devalued. Human dignity is devalued. Every request for suicide, every suicide attempt is a call for help.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everyone is a call for help.
And it's a doctor's obligation, isn't it, to, when a patient requests that, I mean, shouldn't the first response be, why is it that you're asking me this?
Yeah,
you know?
And most doctors don't know anything about,
with the family
about,
not in the room,
right?
I would add, you know, no, seriously, I'm serious about that, because we see this, you know, Loretta and I are both friendly with a local family-owned funeral home director who serves a lot of the Catholic parishes in our area. And, you know, she was telling me, and this is sort of related, that, you know, the way sometimes adult children will behave when a loved one dies, Basically, like, they can't get them dispatched fast enough. And, you know, she wouldn't have wanted a funeral. She wouldn't have wanted a wake. She wouldn't have wanted an obituary. But, you know, at the bottom of some of this stuff is they don't want to spend the money.
Yep.
They don't want to spend the money. And so you could have someone who was a weekly communicant who never missed mass, who would have been horrified to know that he or she was not getting a funeral. And in fact, I was at a continuing legal education class a couple years ago with a rabbi. It sounds like a joke. A rabbi, a priest, and a Protestant minister. Or no, it was an imam from the Muslim community, talking about just this very thing, end-of-life religious wishes. And the rabbi said, if you want services, you got to tie it to the your will being dispersed.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
Because your kid, there will be some in the family who would say, I'm not spending money on an obituary. She wouldn't have wanted that, right? So I think we see some of the same dynamics at play with end-of-life care, right?
Yes,
and forgetting
exactly.
I know in the independent living community where my mother was, there were several people who really should have been in the step-up or step-down community, I guess, where they would have had 24/7 care, and they were barely surviving in independent living because they didn't have the capacity for it anymore, but their family didn't want to pay the extra funds. So, you know, they would sometimes find these people passed away in their apartments because they had fallen or et cetera, because the kids would not pay for the additional cost of the...
Oh.
Isn't that awful? You know,
oh,
so I think,
horrible.
You know, again, it's another motivation, I guess, for us to all save for our retirements. And and my children know I will actually come back and haunt them. So so they're not going to pull that with me, I don't think, because I mean it when I say that, Mary. But,
Mary,
one of them, I think, would dispatch me if she had the opportunity to. So.
But Mary and Dr. Mary, while we are on this topic and we are all sitting here so stunned and horrified, besides getting on our knees and praying to Almighty God, what do we do?
We need to contact our state senators and our state representatives and tell them no, assisted suicide is wrong. Medical aid in dying is a bad idea.
Right.
Doctors need to only help people,
right.
not kill people.
Right.
We need to let our legislators know.
Okay, well, people should know that Emmanuel Welch, who my mother used to say should give back his first name.
Yeah.
He is not God with us.
No.
He is the chief sponsor of House Bill 601.
And you know what? He is also the person behind killing the Illinois Tax Opportunity Scholarship for poor children to go to the school of their parents' choice. He is also the one behind killing that bill. So this is a bad guy.
Okay,
and
so.
Senator John Kern, Republican Senator John Kern, he is the lead sponsor of Senate Bill 948.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Just
do you know
it
him?
Up.
Do you know him, Mary?
Yes.
See, sometimes, anyway, the money. So, like, with the abortion industry, right, we always know that money comes along with these yes votes because the abortion industry just has so much money. Is there funding behind this that we know of, like Soros funding or anything like that?
I know the ACLU is behind it.
Yeah,
and I know
and
they
have a lot of money.
They have national money, international money.
And are there like there were in Illinois with our parental notice bill, are there out-of-state groups coming in here also advocating for this?
Compassion and Choices is
a national organization.
A national
they have a lot of money. Well, tell us, Mary, have you been working with the Catholic Conference of Illinois in the opposition to this? And
yes.
Is that a resource we could direct, since this is a Catholic show, that we could direct our listeners to?
Yes, but again, I think that we need to go as citizens to our state representatives.
Right, but
and
sometimes
senators.
They have, Mary, I'm sorry to interrupt. They have, for example, like a link you can click on
with
you put in your address and it'll take you to your state rep right away.
Yes,
so you don't have to do that legwork.
Okay, I do not have that link.
Okay, I can't, I'm sorry, we're having some technical difficulties, so I can't pull that up, but we can get it onto our show notes after the show is
do.
Over.
Please do.
And,
that's what everybody
make sure that we'll have
do.
That available for people. But I know. You know, Robert Gilligan, the executive director there, is so passionately pro-life, and I know he will be, he'll be working to defeat something like this.
He has been working very hard on this. He has been for a couple of years already.
Right, I know, and it's, and I know that Illinois Tax Credit Scholarship, which is just, heart-wrenching. And, you know, you talk about, we've just been talking about, you know, the poor and people in desperate situations, and the average median income of a child who receives one of those scholarships for a family of four is less than $42,000.
Wow.
And when you consider that in the state of Illinois, a third of children cannot do math at grade level, and or only a third can do math at grade level, and only a quarter can read at grade level.
Oh, my.
We're just sending children into places where they will not learn. They will not be prepared for life. They will come out. They will work in dangerous jobs if they have jobs at all. And then this is what just feeds this whole, you know, horribly difficult cycle, isn't it?
Oh my, yes.
And it's so, not like there are millions of dollars being poured into the lives of these children. No. Some of the kids that want these scholarships are on a waiting list to come into the better school that they would like to attend, even now, even into January. So it is a blessing to the kids and the families. It is a blessing to the schools that are providing excellent educations. And they're going to take it away? I mean, we're finally doing something right in Illinois. It's craziness.
Yeah. No, it was such a gift. It was such a gift. And
we need to get it back.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and we need to not let it go. So contact your legislators and tell them also you want to save the scholarship fund.
Well, and then so, Dr. Kirchhoff, in our last minutes, you know, you are so eloquent about the people that you care for and their dignity as human beings. I'd just like you to say, because this is something you made me aware of that I wasn't, something called soft euthanasia. Can you just, as we close, describe what that is and why we should also be very wary of that?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure what you're referring to,
So
Mary.
Soft euthanasia, when medication, I believe what you were saying to me, I actually wrote down notes when we talked about this, so let me pull them up. But, you know, when patients are not given assertive care and
yes, there are reports across the country of individuals who are in some palliative care and hospice situations.
Right.
They're running out of money and they are given pain medicines to the point of death, even when they're not experiencing
pain. Right, and you were telling me about something called the NORA project.
The NORA project is not related to this, though.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
No,
so,
the NORA project is something different.
That's caring for people with disabilities?
Yes. No, the NORA project is an advocacy group for children with disabilities. We should talk about that another time.
Okay,
we should have them come on.
Okay, well, we'd love to have you come back. Well, we'd love to have you come back on because it is always such a joy to talk with you. And you know, we'll have you, but as this legislation proceeds, I hope you will keep us appraised of what's going on so that we can, you know, even if you can only come on for 15 minutes, we'd love to have you back just to keep us up to date, what we can be doing, if there's anything new that happens. But in the meantime, too, listeners, again, take Dr. Kirchhoff's advice here, and please do reach out to your legislator to tell them we do not want assisted suicide in the state of Illinois. All your protections at the end of the day will mean nothing for a family member who wants to bump off, you know, somebody in the family who is costing them a lot of money and difficulty. And there are alternatives. If a person, as you have said, is in spiritual pain, emotional pain, or physical pain, we have ways that we can address those problems.
Yeah, so, we need to eliminate the suffering, not the sufferer.
Right. Very, yes. You have said that better than I ever could. And is there any website associated with this we could direct listeners to other than the Catholic Conference?
Patient Rights Action Council.
Okay, Patients Rights Action Council. And then listeners, we'll get that into the show notes as well. Well, Dr. Mary King Kirchhoff, God bless you for all of your hard work on this.
God
Thank
bless you
so much
God
for being with us
you.
Today.
Thank
all right,
you.
Listeners, have a great week. We'll see you next Monday.
Thank you.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shadow.